From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a Bosnian filmmaker trapped by the siege in Sarajevo, who has documented the war on videotape with the help of other filmmakers and film students. He describes the films as pictures of love, courage, despair, and crime, made under a total blockade and continuous artillery, machine gun, and sniper fire. Also today, and that's the way it is, Walter Cronkite tells us why his famous sign-off is now an embarrassment. Cronkite has a new documentary on the Discovery Channel. And book critic John Leonard reviews the new memoir, New York Days, by Willie Morris, about his tenure editing Harper's Magazine. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton has ordered a U.S. troop ship out of Haitian waters and says he won't send American soldiers until Haiti's military rulers honor their agreements. The ship, the Harlan County, was turned away from the dock at Port-au-Prince yesterday by a mob of armed men. General Raoul Cedras, Haiti's top military man, reportedly refused to take responsibility for the safety of American and Canadian soldiers who are part of the UN peace mission. The president said he won't send Americans to Haiti if they can't perform their non-combat missions. A fifth juror has been replaced in the Los Angeles trial of two black men accused of attacking white trucker Reginald Denny and seven others in last year's riots. Today's switch follows the dismissal yesterday of a juror who was removed from the panel at the request of the others. From Los Angeles, NPR's Renee Montaigne reports.
The musical chairs being played in the jury room is most unusual at this stage, 12 days after deliberations began. Just yesterday, the jury was told to go back to square one after the judge replaced with an alternate, a middle-aged black juror, after other jurors complained that she was not capable of deliberating. The juror replaced today was the only white man to have been seated in this racially charged case. This time, the anonymous juror, known as number 152, asked the judge to release him, citing personal problems that were unrelated to the case itself. He's been replaced by an alternate, this time a black man, thus maintaining the diversity of the jury. The jury had reached verdicts on two of the 12 felony counts against Damian Williams and Henry Watson. Those verdicts have now been thrown out, and deliberations have once again begun anew. At the Los Angeles County Criminal Courthouse, this is Renee Montaigne.
Two UN relief convoys are still being held up by Bosnian Serbs, and another Red Cross mission had to turn back from a Muslim enclave after a car hit a landmine. The setbacks come as aid officials warn that thousands of people could starve if the war goes on through the winter. From Zagreb, Richard Carruthers reports.
The UN convoys should be en route to the northern towns of Maglaj and Tesanje, where more than 140,000 people are trapped. But trucks carrying food and medicines are still stuck in the Bosnian Serb stronghold of Banja Luka, where they've waited 3 days for permission to move. An international Red Cross aid convoy headed for the same area retreated after its lead vehicle hit a mine on the road. That's despite assurances from all warring sides the route was safe. No one was injured in the car, which was armor-plated. In Sarajevo, the UN warned more people face starvation and disease this winter. Many countries who donated aid last year haven't promised to help again. For National Public Radio, this is Richard Carruthers in Zagreb.
The Dow Industrials were down a fraction today. This is NPR. U.S. intelligence officials say that China and Israel appear to be moving toward more extensive cooperation on developing military technologies. In testimony before a Senate panel, CIA Director James Woolsey said that China is looking for Israeli help in developing advanced engines for tanks and airplane radar systems. Woolsey said that both sides may be hoping to recoup some of the costs of their weapons programs. A top Israeli defense official confirmed today that Israel has been selling arms to China, but he declined to comment on the CIA report. The trial of former Louisiana lawmaker David Duke began today in Baton Rouge. The one-time Ku Klux Klan Grand Wizard is accused of violating state campaign finance laws during his run for governor 2 years ago. Jim Engster reports from Baton Rouge.
Duke is accused of receiving cash contributions at rallies and not reporting the names and addresses of the donors. One contributor was listed as Wally M. Wonderful of 101 Wonderful Way, Mount Wonderful, California. Duke disputes the allegation, saying the trial is a political vendetta.
I should have the right to a jury trial. It's hard to believe that they have a situation where they can try to ruin my political future and fine me thousands of dollars without the right to a jury of my peers.
Duke's former state campaign coordinator, Bob Hawks, testified that the candidate put cash contributions in his pocket or gave it to his bodyguards during his 1991 run for governor. For National Public Radio, I'm Jim Inkster in Baton Rouge.
A judge in Arkansas ruled today that Walmart stores were guilty of predatory pricing. Walmart, the nation's biggest retailer, was accused of trying to force its competitors out of business by selling some products below cost. The judges said Walmart violated state law, and they awarded damages to three independent Arkansas pharmacies. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When the siege of Sarajevo started, Adamir Kenevich picked up his camera and started videotaping the war. He organized a group of filmmakers and film students to do the same. They call themselves the Sarajevo Group of Authors, known by the acronym SAGA. The New York Times described SAGA's films as a handheld view from ground zero of the war's civilian victims, as shot by video makers from all major ethnic and religious groups, working without press passes, armed escorts, or flak jackets, and creating haunting, if technically erratic, affidavits of sudden death in Sarajevo. A collection of SAGA films are showing at the New York Film Festival. Kenevich managed to get to New York for the festival. He'll then return to Sarajevo, where he is, believe it or not, organizing a film festival scheduled to begin later this month. Kenevich is a professor of film in Sarajevo. He told me it was a natural impulse to start videotaping when the siege began.
I just couldn't be passive. And I was mad at somebody keeping me at prison without any trial or without any obvious guilt. And I wanted to react on that. Well, my reaction, of course, could be lots of different moves, but I just assumed that the best thing is to try to document what we could document in from our point of view.
How did you organize filmmakers, film students, and amateurs into the group that you put together?
Well, SAGA, as I said, used to exist as a little private production company. And at the beginning of the war, we just called everybody who felt like us, who felt that we should try to form some of our independent-minded project, which will show our point of view. We just called everybody, and people just came. We just started to find out the ways to survive. For example, salary for everybody was a loaf of bread, and we from time to time find out the way to find the people's cigarettes, because a lot of people in cigarettes and over there smoke. Then we find out the way to make to get some diesel for our generators, although, for example, the price of diesel is unbelievable, like, for example, $80 per gallon on some kind of black market.
How do you get film and video? I imagine that's really hard to come by now.
Yeah, everything we do on video. And we did have some stock of tapes. We did have some equipment, cameras, like height, U-matic, Beta. We had a couple of mobile complex, and but then we were trying to find from everybody in Sarajevo who had stocked in their houses or little studios. So we just exchanged it for something. Somebody gave us some food or something. We bought it, or then we just from time to time Some friends gave us a couple of cassettes. For example, Annie Leibovitz gave
us the photographer.
The photographer gave me 20 Hi-8 cassettes, which I was very happy about, and I'm grateful to her, and so on.
Since Sarajevo doesn't have electricity, can you show these tapes to anybody in Sarajevo?
Well, you use the generators mainly to make the screenings. We made a couple of screenings for people in Sarajevo, and now TV BNH is showing like every week one of our little documentaries. And unfortunately, people are not seeing it very much because there is, as you said, no electricity. But you know, I think these footage are now maybe more precious to see outside of Sarajevo than inside of Sarajevo.
Well, you're out of Sarajevo temporarily. You're in New York to show some of your films at the New York Film Festival. How did you manage to get out of Sarajevo?
Well, it's almost impossible to get out of Sarajevo, and I had that luck that Soros Foundation just helped me to get all possible papers to happen the UN military APC, then UN military planes. So I found out I just appeared in Italy, where I got all possible visas, so I'm gonna go back the same way, just in time to get to Sarajevo Film Festival, which is going to be on 23rd of October.
Why do you want to go back to Sarajevo? Would you be able to stay in the States or in Europe if you wanted to?
Well, of course, I would be able to stay anywhere I would want to, but I live in Sarajevo. You know, that's the place where I live, and that's the place where I work, and that's the place where I have a lot of people who think just the same as me, and I'm considering that Sarajevo is not. What's happening in Sarajevo is not a local problem, and hell is going to spread anywhere else if the problem in Sarajevo is not solved. And I wouldn't be, I wouldn't feel secure on New Zealand if what's happening in Sarajevo becomes a paradigm of supporting the extreme nationalism and hell, which is. Which has been made to a people of Sarajevo. You know, we people in Sarajevo are not anymore in position to be scared. We lost that kind of a feeling. You know, we just we faced something which could be called as a Third World War, and we just feel that it shouldn't be supported by anything. Even by our deserting of Sarajevo, because I think that we people in Sarajevo are showing that that what's being imposed upon us, that horror, that fascism, which is a mild word, what's going on to Sarajevo, cannot win and shouldn't win. And we just... have to face that challenge and just to show the other rest of the world that it is a dangerous thing which could spread very widely.
You were born in Sarajevo in 1950. You're from a Muslim background. Did you ever feel discriminated against? Did you ever feel anti-Muslim hatred before the war started?
First of all, Bosnia was mainly always a secular country, and then nobody ever paid attention on a religious part of that. People were just not religious mainly. Like you can say that 10% of the old people were religious, you know. So we just... we are just we were always mixed We are, first of all, Slavic origin. Came there our ancestors like 6th or 7th century. And then probably mixed with some people who were living over there too. Then some religion came, Catholicism. Some people took it. Some other came Orthodox, then Islamic. Then Jews came 500 years ago. So the way of life was just a normal mixture of different culture, different religious, with the deepest respect for every of them. But we in Sarajevo never felt that's something which is... Like the first thing you are defining somebody with. Well, for me, they were always asking me, well, what are you? I always used to say that I'm a film director. And nationally minded, nothing especially important.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ademir Kenovic, and he founded SAGA, which is the acronym for the Sarajevo Group of Authors. It's a group of professional student and amateur film and theater people who were documenting life during the war in Sarajevo. Some of his movies will be shown at the New York Film Festival, and that's why he's on this brief visit to the United States. We're going to take a short break, then we'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bosnian filmmaker Ademir Kenovic, who is on a brief visit to New York to show some of his films and some of the films of the film group that he founded. What is your typical day like now in Sarajevo? Do you have anything that you could call a typical day?
Well, first of all, I live in a downtown, and I'm a refugee in one of the apartments where I live with a couple of my friends. My house has been captured by those on the mountains because it was out of the city. And I usually, in Sarajevo you just go on different hunts. You hunt for the water, then you hunt for the food, then you just try to help other people, your friends, your relatives, your father, and so on, to find something, you know. So people just roam around, you know, trying to find something, you know, flour, humanitarian aid, piece of something, can, or, you know, no matter is it dangerous or not, people from Sarajevo are going to get water. It's a very strong hygiene tradition. So people from Sarajevo are having water, no matter is it possible or no. And that's probably one of the reasons why you don't have spread all kinds of different diseases, you know, because if there wouldn't be so, you know, a lot of people would get just a different, you know, diarrheas or whatever those diseases are. So we just then go to our SAGA office. We live in a kind of commune, video commune, TV, film commune. We just all my friends, filmmakers, students, some of them are living over there, some of them are just coming in the morning, 9:30. Then we just go. We have a shooting every day, one crew, two crews, three crews. We have editings every day. And now, exactly this time, we are finishing the editing of a film which we made following the Susan Sontag, who was making Godot, Waiting for Godot in Sarajevo. It's going to be, I guess, fascinating document about how you make a play in Sarajevo while actors are waiting for the food, waiting for the water. Some actors' wives are waiting for the kids, waiting for the eventual support from the outside world and so on. So we mainly work all day long. We just work and try to communicate with the outside world.
If you didn't have work, if you didn't have film, do you think you'd lose your mind?
Well, I didn't say we didn't lose our minds, but I think the work helps to preserve the control of some of the parts of the mind, you know. And I think, well, we think under the situation we are in, we just think that it's inevitable to work because we want to not only to show the world now what's happening and not show the world the state of minds of filmmakers also, but we think and we are definitely sure that we have to preserve these documents which we have now more than 100 hours for next decades to come, because this period, unfortunately, in the place where I live, will be probably subject of investigations for next decades.
Has your life gone through certain phases during the war?
It's extremely dense situation. So you just change your feelings of extreme desperation, happiness, rage, this scorn to everybody who is not in Sarajevo. In fact, most of the people in Sarajevo despise everything and everybody which is just not acting, not doing anything to try to understand what's happening in Sarajevo. So you are going through different phases. It's just, for example, absolutely, devastating desperation gets you when you cannot communicate over the phone for a couple of weeks, for example, where you don't know anything, what's happening with your close family or friends.
I want to get back to some of the films that you made that we'll be showing at the New York Film Festival. One of the films is an interview with a Serb who describes in the movie how he learned how to slit throats by practicing on pigs. He describes a mass rape, a gang rape that he participated in, and how they were told by people in the military that they should participate in these rapes to keep up combat morale. And after one of the rapes, they killed the woman. Put a pistol shot through her head. How did you find this person, and who was actually doing the interview?
I was told by somebody I knew that several people from the other side were caught. So I just asked some people. I went straight to the prison. I asked, "Can I see the person? Because I would like to." Just to make sure that these people exist and that I wanted to know who they are. So they allowed me, and I John Burns knew that I'm going to do that. He found out.
John Burns of the New York Times.
Yes, and he asked me to come with me while we were shooting this documentary. So I took him together with me. So I wanted to preserve authenticity of it, and I just wanted to make sure that everything is okay. So we just it wasn't an investigation, it was the time before he was investigated on the court. I just wanted to have this conversation, and the guy who was asking him was I guess one of the prison chiefs or military prison director or something, and there was John, there was me too. I was just asking him just normal questions like, what kind of music does he like, and is he religious, and so on.
What was it like for you to be in a room with one of the people responsible for the war and for the atrocities?
I was, in fact, a lot of people asked me that, and well, I was curious to see what are the people like who are doing that and what's behind that. And after we shot this 7-hour long interview, I found out that unfortunately for him, he's just transparently showing that he, through him, system which made him speaks, he's just a poor creature who was taken into that system and made do these things.
How does it feel now to briefly be outside of the war, to briefly be in New York, knowing that you'll be going right back into the war when the film festival's over?
Well, just like being on another galaxy. And you see, we are not living only on another planet in Sarajevo or another galaxy. It's like you are going to ride to a time machine and going a couple of centuries back, because it's what's happening is you can just compare it with some kind of medieval unbelievableness.
When the Sarajevo Film Festival that you're organizing starts later in October, what kinds of outside movies will you be bringing in? What seems most appropriate to show now in Sarajevo?
Well, everything seems appropriate to show in Sarajevo. I mean, we just want to assure everybody that we want to keep on living normally. We just don't want to make any kind of revolutionary statements, nor any kind of new democratia thing or...
No big manifestos?
No. We just want to say that we just are like other people. We never thought nor dreamt that we'll be kept in prison like animals in zoo. So we just want a normal life with normal selection of movies.
Are you going to bring in comedies? Does it feel...
Of course.
Does it feel like wrong to laugh at a time like that? Or does it feel like, well, that's what you need?
No, it's wrong. It's not wrong to laugh in Sarajevo. In Sarajevo, people always have been making jokes. And even now, and the most often they make jokes about Sarajevo. Like this one, the latest one, what's the difference between Auschwitz and Sarajevo? And the difference is because Auschwitz had gas.
Oh, God. Edimir Kenović is a professor of film and a filmmaker living in Sarajevo. The videotapes of Bosnia Under Siege by Kenović and his group Saga are showing at the New York Film Festival today and Saturday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Walter Cronkite does play-by-play. The former news anchor, who was known as the most trusted man in America, shares some highlights of his career, including his days as a radio sportscaster. Cronkite hosts a new documentary on the failure of integration 30 years after the Civil Rights Movement. And book critic John Leonard reviews the new memoir, New York Days, by Willie Morris, former editor-in-chief of Harper's Magazine. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton has ordered a U.S. ship out of Haitian waters after 200 non-combat U.S. and Canadian soldiers were prevented from landing yesterday by gunmen on shore. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
President Clinton said that the United States would press to reimpose United Nations Security Council economic sanctions against Haiti. The announcement came after a ship carrying American and Canadian troops was prevented from docking at the capital, Port-au-Prince, by police and soldiers opposed to the return of exiled President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. The president said U.S. troops would not be committed to Haiti until the island nation's military rulers provided a safe and secure environment for them to land. President Clinton said that Haiti's military ruler, Lieutenant General Raoul Cedras, had reneged on an agreement he made last July to restore constitutional rule to Haiti. The events are an apparent setback to those efforts and may also delay the scheduled return of Aristide to Haiti in 2 weeks. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
Even as Russian leader Boris Yeltsin continues a trip to Tokyo, government officials in Moscow are announcing changes in Russia. Officials say that prosecutors may soon get broad new powers in a fight against crime. Officials say that a new law will enable Russian officials to continue their crackdown against crime after emergency regulations are lifted. Officials also say that a new military document long sought by the army will be adopted. Military leaders want changes in a number of areas, along with better housing and pay. Military leaders may also call for a say in arms control. Officials in Cairo have confirmed that Mahmoud Abbas will lead the Palestinian delegation at an Israeli PLO meeting in the Egyptian capital tomorrow. Laurie Neff reports from Cairo.
The Palestinian ambassador to Egypt, Saeed Kamel, has confirmed the PLO delegation will be led by Mahmoud Abbas, head of the organization's international department. Israeli officials yesterday said their delegation is being led by Foreign Minister Shimon Peres. Abbas and Peres signed the Israeli PLO peace accord in Washington last month. The Cairo committee will supervise all Israeli PLO negotiations and will decide the makeup of an Israeli PLO economic committee. Another panel meets tomorrow in Egypt's Red Sea resort of Taba to discuss Israeli withdrawal from the Gaza Strip and the West Bank town of Jericho. Delegations to that meeting will be led by Major General Anan Shahak, Deputy Chief of Staff of the Israeli Defense Forces, and Nabil Shaff, a key advisor to PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat. For National Public Radio, I'm Laurie Neff in Cairo.
The government says that sales of U.S. savings bonds dropped 8.8% last month. Over the last 8 months, bond sales have gone down 6 times. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down less than 1 point to close at 3,593.13 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. 3 former U.S. presidents are leading a group announcing their support for the North American Free Trade Agreement. Former Presidents Ford, Carter, and Bush have announced their support for the plan that they say is a positive step forward for the United States and its relations with neighbors in the rest of the world. A statement said that they believe this agreement will create the largest, most productive free trade area in the world. A judge has sentenced to lengthy prison terms the 2 former Detroit police officers convicted in the beating death of black motorist Malice Green. Phil Denary of member station WDET reports from Detroit.
Former officer Larry Nevers was sentenced to 12 to 25 years in prison for his role in the death of Malice Green. His partner, Walter Budzin, received a sentence of 8 to 18 years. Judge George Crockett said he felt that Nevers intended to do great bodily harm to Malice Green when he hit Green in the head repeatedly with a heavy police flashlight, and as a result, Green died.
Your were the blows that resulted in the death of Malice Green.
The judge said Budson, who received the lighter sentence, did not intend to harm Green, but also did not stop his partner from inflicting the deadly blows. Green died after the officers beat him with their flashlights when he resisted them outside a crack house on a night last November. The men could have been sentenced to life in prison, but the sentences do fall within the range of those suggested by state guidelines. For National Public Radio, this is Phil Denieri in Detroit.
In Bosnia, a landmine exploded near an aid convoy today, forcing it to turn around. The UN convoy was carrying food and blankets to some 150,000 people in a Muslim area cut off by fighting since the 1st of June. Two other UN convoys have also been blocked by Serbian forces. UN officials are trying to get food to some 3 million people before winter. In 18 months of fighting, some 200,000 people are dead or missing. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm not sure who Americans consider the most trusted man in America today, but for many years that description was linked to the name Walter Cronkite. Cronkite was the anchor and managing editor of the CBS Evening News for 19 years. He retired in 1981 and was replaced by Dan Rather. But he never really left television. There's a new edition of his documentary series, The Cronkite Report, which will be shown next Monday on the Discovery Channel. It's called The Faltering Dream, and it examines the state of integration 30 years after Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. We thought this would be a good time to catch up with Cronkite and get him to tell us some behind-the-scenes stories from his years in television. He told me about the first time he anchored the news on April 16, 1962.
I remember my dear friend Andy Rooney, who I've known since World War II when we were in England and Europe together as correspondents. I remember his coming into the studio immediately after that 15-minute broadcast, and he said to me in his typical straightforward, no-holds-barred way, "What are you trying to sell me? you're punching too hard, Cronkite. You're punching. Don't sell me anything. Just tell me the news." And that was the first words I heard after I finished the first broadcast. And I appreciated it. And he was right, absolutely right.
How did you start saying at the end of your broadcast, "And that's the way it is"?
Well, that was a very contrived sign-off, obviously. And I'm a little embarrassed about it today. Dick Salant, the sainted late Richard Salant, who was president of CBS News when we went to the half hour, hated it and tried to talk me out of it. But being the stubborn Dutchman I am, I clung to it, and it became so much a signature so quickly that I was not inclined to give it up. But what happened was when we went from a half hour to a half hour. I thought we'd have plenty of time. Fool that I was, naive as I was, I thought that doubling our time would give me time to end the piece with the kind of stories I always liked when I worked for the United Press and Scripps Howard. I liked the irony of fate stories, the little one-paragraph stories or two-paragraph stories that you put under an italicized head somewhere in the front page. And they were the little human interest touches. And if I use that kind of story, knowing that sign-off lines were terribly popular in broadcasting and always have worked for people, I thought maybe I could use one if I could find one that I could say as a tagline to either a humorous or a pathetic story. And you can say, "And that's the way it is," almost anyway. "And that's the way it is," you know, an ironic touch, or a satirical touch, or doubting touch, and "that's the way it is," a sad touch, and a regretful touch. And so that's why I devised the line, and it certainly has stuck.
You say you're embarrassed about it now. Why are you embarrassed?
Because I think Dick Salant was right. We didn't get to use those irony of fate stories. Almost from the beginning of the evening news, things were so... There was so much news to cover in the half hour allotted to us, less than that, less subtracting commercials and lead-ins and lead-outs and so forth. There was so much to cover. we never got those irony of fate stories in. As a result, we were loading the broadcast with important news, and I was ending up saying, and that's the way it is, an arrogant line, in a sense.
Right, that's how some people saw it, that you were saying, I've told you what the news is, and that's all there is.
Well, not only that's all there is, but it's all correct.
Yeah, right.
And as Dick pointed out, we're not telling them all that is, and we make mistakes.
You were the anchor and managing editor of the Evening News. When you became the anchor and managing editor, what were some of the changes you made or tried to make?
Well, I think the most important change was that I insisted on doing the broadcast from the desk where I worked, so there would not be a delay in getting from the newsroom to the broadcast location, the studio. And also, I would be in control throughout the half hour of the broadcast. The reason for that was that I really was the managing editor, and I did not want to put copy on the air that somebody had prepared and handed to me. I wanted to see it off the wires. I wanted to make my own judgment on it before going on the air with it. And that was possible if we were in the newsroom operating. They could hand me the press service copy, the teletypes bringing the press service copy could be practically at my elbow. And I could have writers and researchers sitting around the rim of the anchor desk, just as they would on a newspaper. I played it that way.
Well, speaking for myself, if I did a broadcast from my office, instead of hearing what I was talking about, listeners or viewers would just be saying, what a mess. You must have been under a lot of pressure to keep a pretty neat desk if you were broadcasting from it.
Not really. We swept the desk clean about 1.5 minute before going on the air. My motto was, our deadline is when we leave the air. We changed the broadcast right through to the time I signed off. It very seldom ended up precisely as we had planned it in advance. It drove producers and directors and technicians crazy, but that's the way I believed it should be done. There was no reason we had to close out the broadcast before we went on the air. If you've got capable people who can handle it on the microphone, on the cameras, and in the control room, there's no reason why you can't update that broadcast to the very last second.
My guest is Walter Cronkite, and there's a new edition of the Cronkite Report that will be shown next Monday on the Discovery Channel. It's called The Faltering Dream. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Walter Cronkite. Now, in your early days in radio, one of the things you did was the kind of baseball broadcast that Ronald Reagan did early in his career, play-by-play through telegraph announcements. So yeah. you'd get the telegraph announcements of what was happening, and you'd do your play-by-play based on that. It's hard for me to imagine you getting really worked up on the radio about a home run. I've never heard you in that kind of excited state that we expect from sportscasters.
You missed a great deal of the best of my broadcasting. Johnson's up at the plate now, and he's got a pretty good record against this pitcher, but we can't expect a lot today. He hadn't been doing very well lately. But here's the first pitch, and it's a strike. It's a strike against Johnson. He took that one looking at it. He's up there again now, and there's another pitch. Oh, and there's a hit. It's a hit. It's on the way out. It looked like it's a home run for Johnson. He's on the way. He's driving Boggs in ahead of him, and it's a two-run lead for the Yankees. You don't like that, huh?
That's fine. That's fine. It seems out of character. Very interesting. Well, I can't, you know, for somebody who's been such the journalist, what was it like to reconstruct ball games as if you were there when you really weren't?
It was phony. No, it wasn't really phony so much. The facts were all correct. The excitement was that was correct too in a way. I was excited about how the game went. I think there was a little bit of showmanship in it, quite clearly, which I wouldn't have permitted in news broadcasting. But it's a different, excuse the expression, ball game.
Right. Let's talk about what I think for many Americans it was one of your most memorable moments as a broadcaster, and I mean, it was a shocking moment in broadcasting. I'm sure you know what I'm getting at. It was a day Kennedy was shot, and you made the announcement on CBS that he was shot, and then made the announcement that he was dead. How did you end up being the one to go on the air?
Well, I was the one who carried most of the burden of our spontaneous or extemporaneous news coverage in those days. I was the anchorman of the evening news and usually the broadcaster of conventions, elections, things of that kind. So it would not have been unnatural for me to do it. But actually, the fact was that I was in the newsroom preparing the evening news broadcast. I was there right when the wires. The United Press had the beep. Merriman Smith, the White House correspondent for United Press, got the first break, and the bulletin bells rang on the machine. We all gathered around, and there was the news that shots rang out, and today is President Kennedy's motorcade toward the streets of Dallas. Bing, 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 another bulletin. Motorcade is broken up, and it appears that it's on the way to a hospital. President Kennedy may have been hit. And with that, well, we immediately ordered up the air and went on the air. We couldn't get the camera warm immediately. In those days, we didn't keep one warm for those purposes, although after this experience, we did. But they started warming up a camera and moving it into place in the newsroom. And meanwhile, I went into an announce booth and went on the air as a voiceover over a bulletin slide over a soap opera that was on at the time.
When you went on to say that Kennedy was dead, your eyes teared. And that's something that we've seen replayed so many times on, you know, every anniversary of the death. And I mean, it's become one of these historic moments of broadcasting. Were you concerned about getting emotional on the air? Did you try to be as emotionless and stoic as possible? And were you concerned when you realized that your eye was tearing?
Well, I wasn't concerned about my eye tearing. I was concerned about my voice choking and not being able to speak. And that concerned me quite a lot. The tearing didn't matter. I certainly... I didn't really think about it, except the concern that I wouldn't be able to get the words out.
How close did you come to not being able to get them out?
Pretty close, I think. I remember a moment of real terror that I was going to choke up and fall apart, as it were.
Did you know Kennedy?
Oh, yes. Yes, I knew him from the time he was a senator, and I knew him fairly well, not intimately, but I knew him as one of the many news sources in Washington.
Mm-hmm. As a journalist and broadcaster, did you think it was acceptable to let some emotion show?
Oh, yes, I think it was then, and I think it is now. I don't think if one happens to be an emotional type and has a little problem with that, perhaps, that there should necessarily try to suppress it. It could be overdone. I mean, if one were so emotional that every story broke him up, that would be unacceptable, obviously. But to have it happen once or twice in a broadcasting career is not that exceptional.
I realize that you are not fully retired. You're still doing documentaries and many other things as well. But you are retired from the evening news. What has surprised you about your retirement?
That CBS did not make any further use of me. My contract called for me to be doing special events broadcasting and a series of broadcasts similar to one I'd had on when I stepped down from the evening news called Walter Cronkite's Universe, a 13-week summer replacement series. And because there's a change of command at CBS they had their own reasons why they did not use me at all. And I was very much surprised about that.
And angry?
Yes, I think so.
So what are your impressions now of the CBS Evening News with Dan Rather and Connie Chung?
I think they're doing a fine job. Now, what do you expect me to say? No, I really do. I think that all three of the networks are doing well. I'm disappointed at the trend of all three networks to featureize the news. Without telling you which network I think does this most often, I try to stick with that at network, which I think is covering the news and not going to give me a long prepared feature story.
And you won't say which one that is?
No.
All right. The word most often used to describe you, I think, has been avuncular. And in fact, your nickname to a lot of people was Uncle Walter. So what did you think of the avuncular title and the uncle title?
In retrospect, I love it because the subsequent appellation was fatherly Walter Cronkite, and then it got to be grandfatherly Walter Cronkite. So I'll go back to avuncular any day.
And how'd you feel about it at the time?
Oh, I thought it was kind of affectionate. I didn't care. I mean, it was rather nice.
Walter Cronkite. The next edition of the Cronkite Report will be shown Monday evening on the Discovery Channel. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what do you have from Haiti?
We are going to be talking to some reporters in Haiti about what the situation is like there, see if we can get some feeling for what is going on in the capital. And then Suni Khalid will be telling us what is going on here as the United States responds to events in Haiti. We're also taking another look at Somalia as the two situations threaten to sort of merge in the minds of many Americans. We have a feature from Hartford, Connecticut, which has established a curfew for young people in order to try to deal with gang violence, and an update on the Nobel Prizes.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Every generation has its bright young literary stars. In the late 60s, Willie Morris was one of New York's brightest. His new memoir, New York Days, chronicles the ups and downs of those times and the personalities that made them so lively. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
Most of the reviews of Willie Morris's absorbing memoir, like most of the memoir itself, stick to his rise and fall at Harper's Magazine. The Boy from Yazoo, Mississippi, by way of Oxford and the Texas Observer, took over as editor-in-chief in 1967, wanting to go to all the parties and wanting to change the whole world. He was forced out in 1971 by the Cowles family ownership and their biz school backstabbers, waving readers' surveys. It's payback time. The only revenge a writer's got on the bean counters who buy and sell him like a yo-yo or a pork future is to give us a book that pins them down through their buggy little eyes to a page of style, impales them on a consummate disdain. Even if Willie and his boys drank too much and ate too often at Elaine's, any magazine that in 5 years managed to publish Norman Mailer on the Armies of the Night, David Halberstam on The Best and the Brightest, Irving Howe on the New York Intellectuals, and Seymour Hersh on the My Lai Massacre was doing wonderfully well, thank you, no matter what they muttered at the country club in Minneapolis, before John Cowles Jr. himself descended into est, nude dancing, and primal scream. But Morris, whose sweet tooth for the elegiac is notorious, has splendid passages as well, on his Rhodes Scholar days in Oxford, where his best friend was Dennis Potter, the singing detective, and on Manhattan as a ghostly moonscape, where the anonymous dead stare up at you, their own ambitions dashed, only fossils for the forensic anthropologists. And on poor Ralph Ellison, being called an Uncle Tom in the late 60s at Grinnell College in bloodthirsty Iowa. And most movingly, on marriage, the first casualty of vaulting ambition, after which the liver and the ego. He stands outside an office building, possessed as if in Dostoevsky, waiting to stalk his wife's psychiatrist, as once upon a time he'd followed Greta Garbo. Always, however, we come back to the magazine, more than a marriage, an affair to remember. Sure, there's lots of name-dropping, the Elaines, Hamptons, Commentary, and Plimpton crowds, plus Andy Warhol and Lauren Bacall. But they are excellent names to drop, which is why some of us came from the provinces to begin with, and also why we read memoirs. And sometimes there's a sting attached. Morris, for instance, was a buddy of Norman Podhoretz's back in his social justice days, before the Pod went right-wing neocon. He quotes Oscar Levant on Doris Day. I knew her before she was a virgin. I have some thoughts. The New Yorker in the 60s was a better magazine than Harper's, and Esquire was just as good. The New York Review of Books was more audacious, and National Review discovered more new writers, as would Rolling Stone. Fellows as fine as Willie, and females too, will always be fired, like his friend Bill Moyers at Newsday, his competitor Bob Manning at The Atlantic, almost anybody who ever works for Newhouse, even Edward R. Murrow at CBS. In every institution of our society, brilliant young men find surrogate fathers, and imagine in this relationship of privilege and protection that they can go on being brilliant on their own terms forever. But in a corporate culture, we aren't fathers and sons. We are landlords and tenants. We are owners and pets. It shouldn't surprise the brilliant young men, and yet it always surprises the brilliant young men when the party's over and the pets are put to sleep.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed New York Days by Willie Morris. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlease and Peter Clowney. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, facing terminal illness, Dr. David Spiegel discusses his study of the therapeutic effects of support groups. Spiegel criticizes modern medicine for focusing on the illness, often ignoring the person who has it. But he criticizes alternative medicine for believing you can wish away an illness. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.